such an important topic of all. I mean, I've done over 400 interviews, but I can't think of a more pressing issue that people should hear about. I mean, because it just seems like now cancer is everywhere. Both my parents had it. I have cousins and aunts and uncles. I mean, even my cat got cancer, which I'm like, what is this epidemic with cancer?
Yeah, it's only getting worse. It's not getting better.
Right. And you bring up an interesting point where you say, you know, we keep giving money to all these, you know, these fundraisers, we're raising money for cancer research, and it's still getting worse. It seems like if we're giving more money, it should be, and the research is getting funding, shouldn't the rates be dropping?
Yeah, absolutely. So, but nobody's asking why.
Right. So you bring up an interesting point that we're looking at the disease wrong. It's not a genetic disease, which is what they've said previously. It's actually a metabolic disease.
Yeah. Well, are you on live now? Is this?
Yes.
Yeah. So you're absolutely right. That's a very excellent question. And you should be asking your viewers why they never asked the question. You know, so many people are donating money to all of these foundations, the Susan Komen, you know, Run for Lung, Run for Breast, you know, run for Bladder, Brain. You go down the list of all the different societies of cancer. Everybody feels they're doing something good. And bottom line is the more money they raise, the more cancer we get. And no one seems to ask, what the hell are you doing with the money that we have been giving your society for the last 20 years, and all we have is more cancer to show for it? There's no accountability. You know, it stops at the fundraiser. In other words, all of the emphasis is on getting people, how many people can start running for wherever they're going, and are being sponsored to collect money for the organization. And then the organization takes the money, and what we get is more cancer. And so what are you doing? The questions I always ask is, what are you doing with all the money we're raising? And you can even ask the federal government, National Cancer Institute, same question. We're putting $5 billion a year of American taxpayer money into your organization, and all we get for it is more cancer. And there does not seem to be any accountability, whether it's a government-run organization or whether it's a private-run organization. Their argument, or what they sometimes, and you can test it, test my hypothesis. They'll say, oh, it's an extremely complicated disease, and we're doing all we can to try to stop it. It's not that complicated, and you're not doing all you can to stop it. And then you start getting them upset, angry, and then they kind of discount you. So people have to start asking really hard questions about this. But you know, the obesity is now replacing smoking as the number one risk factor for cancer. And we have an obesity epidemic. Well, can't they put two and two together? Don't they realize that being fat puts you at risk for getting cancer? They don't know that. Can you believe it? We actually ask people, do you know being overweight and obese puts you at, no, I didn't know that. Well, damn it, man. Somebody better get the word out to these folks.
Also so many other conditions, as you talk about, this can be related to type 2 diabetes.
Oh, yeah.
And it basically boils down to a high blood sugar.
Yeah. How do we get that? We eat poorly, highly processed foods. We don't exercise. I mean, it's not that complicated.
Well, it's just ironic, too, because you talk about like Susan B. Komen or whatever, and how they'll advertise these things. Like, I think it was KFC. Had a thing like, oh, we're trying to help raise, you know, cure cancer. I'm like, I think you're causing cancer with your food. And
yeah, but what you just said, nobody's telling them that. Somebody's got to let them know. Apparently they don't know.
Yeah. Well, you know? So your research, it's based on Otto Warburg, which I did a little research on him. What a fascinating guy. This was a guy who was half Jewish.
Yeah.
You know, stood up to the Nazis. I mean, this guy had some big balls. And he kind of identified that cancer, he only had half of it because he said it wasn't a genetic disease. It was metabolic, but he only had half of the problem, the glucose. And you say there's the other half is the glue. Yeah,
that's what we did. That's our big thing. It's not, people say, oh, everybody knows glutamine. Yeah, but everybody misinterpreted how glutamine was driving the cancer. we have shown that it's a fermentation metabolism, not an oxidative metabolism. And that's a big difference for those that are in the field of energy metabolism and cancer. There's two ways to get energy in our body. One is an ancient substrate level phosphorylation. When I say phosphorylation, meaning you add a phosphate group to ADP to produce ATP, adenosine triphosphate, which is the chemical energy equivalent, the transfer of the phosphate to proteins and lipids and things like this changes the configuration. It is energy. Where do we get our energy from? How do we make ATP? We eat food, okay? The energy of the sun creates carbon-hydrogen bonds originally in the food that we eat. Ultimate, all energy comes from the sun. And then when we eat the food, we break those carbon-hydrogen bonds and release, again, the energy of the sun and capture it in ATP. Without ATP, no cell can grow or survive. So the question is, how does the cell make ATP? And there's two predominant mechanisms of making ATP. One is an ancient pathway called substrate level phosphorylation, doesn't require oxygen. And this is the kind of energy that all cells had in the evolution of life on Earth. All life on Earth started from single cells that were using this substrate level phosphorylation because there was no oxygen in the atmosphere at that particular time. Only after cyanobacteria started to produce oxygen did we start to get more complicated structures, multicellular organisms, and eventually us and other mammals and fish and what we see. But every one of us, we're all getting energy from ATP. Well, over this time, these ancient pathways have become minimal. They play an extremely important role in our energy metabolism, as you and I are sitting here breathing. And we're getting energy from oxygen. But the preparation of the fuel source is using these substrate-level phosphorylation as a very minor process. But when the ability of the cell to get energy from oxygen becomes corrupted in any number of ways, the cells gradually fall back on these ancient pathways. And this is what the cancer is using. It's called substrate-level phosphorylation. Warburg described it in the cytoplasm. He received the Nobel Prize for actually defining the protein that actually gets the energy from oxygen in the mitochondrion. But he said these cancer cells aren't using oxygen. They're using this ancient fermentation pathway. And he tried to quantify how much ATP was coming from fermentation versus oxidative respiration. That was where he made one mistake. We now know it's not possible to accurately quantify where the energy is coming from. Our big thing is that we also get energy out of that same organelle, but using an ancient fermentation pathway embodied in that organelle, so the mitochondrion. So the mitochondrion in the cytoplasm produces most of the energy. And that's where we're breathing because the mitochondrion takes in the oxygen and uses it as an acceptor so we can get energy through oxidative phosphorylation. Highly, highly efficient. Highly, highly efficient. Substrate level phosphorylation is inefficient. You have to use a lot of substrate, a lot of material to get a small amount of energy. But the cancer cell has fallen back on these ancient pathways because the organelle that generates the high efficiency energy is no longer efficient. It's inefficient. So the cell uses ancient pathways to grow and reproduce. And the organelle that controls the differentiated stable state of the cells in our tissues, that organelle is the mitochondrion. It's the controller of the differentiated quiescent state. And when that organelle becomes corrupted, inefficient, it falls back on the fermentation and loses the control of the growth of the cells, thereby leading to dysregulated cell growth. Dysregulated cell growth is the definition of cancer. Cancer is cell division out of control, dysregulated cell growth. How did it happen? From a chronic damage, chronic interruption of oxidative phosphorylation with a compensatory fermentation leading to dysregulated cell growth. Very, very clear, very pointed. We just followed in the pathway of Warburg and looked deeply into what he was saying. And we've confirmed almost everything that Warburg was saying, except we have shown that he was in error in trying to quantify the glucose pathway and the amount of energy coming out of the mitochondria from oxidative phosphorylation. He did not know about amino acid fermentation, another fuel that can also generate energy through substrate level phosphorylation, but it occurs in that organelle, the mitochondria. Now we know for sure how these cells are getting their energy, and we know how now to kill them. Because once you know what they're eating, you know how to kill them. So, and people are chasing genes. They're looking at all these mutations in the nucleus, trying to do precision medicine, talking. All those genetic mutations are downstream effects of the abnormal energy metabolism, okay? So that's why we're not making any major advances. We keep chasing things that are downstream and not central to the issue of what's causing the dysregulated cell growth. So constantly we're throwing good money after bad on all these fundraisers and all this stuff. And if you look at the scientific advisory boards, not only for the National Institutes of Health, but also for these various cancer, Susan Coleman and all these others, they all have guys that think cancer is a genetic disease sitting on their scientific advisory board. Therefore, you know you're throwing money, good money after bad, because those guys don't understand the biology of the disorder they're treating.
Yeah, and I think that's at least one person. Have you ever debated any of these?
They don't want to debate me. I've asked for it. Mm-hmm. Obviously.
That's sketchy that they won't talk to you.
Well, bring them on. Why don't you bring somebody on here? We'll have a nice debate. Okay, yeah. Bring somebody on. Get somebody from the gene, get from the NCI, National Cancer Institute. Get the new director of the National Cancer Institute. I'll be happy to discuss this with her.
This would be great.
Well, they say I take an extreme view. Yeah, my extreme view is trying to manage the disease. That's what's extreme.
Right. Well, and because, I mean, that's one of the big things that's changed over, you know, the last few decades with the cancer raising is also our diet and lifestyle. Yeah. And I mean, the food pyramid, this thing is like a joke to me. I mean, now I think they've finally gone off this, but for a while they were telling people to eat 12 to 14 servings of bread and carbohydrates a day.
Yeah, I know, it was upside down. Well, you know, we can look at all that. And, you know, a lot of this is smoke and mirrors and taking people's attention away from the critical issue. Oh, what can I eat? Can I eat this? Can I eat that? You know, cancer can't survive without glucose and glutamine, because they need a fermentation energy metabolism. And those are the only two fuels that can provide enough energy for fermentation. We interrogated all other fuels and nothing can keep these damn cells alive except glucose and glutamine. And they can't use fatty acids or ketone bodies. Clearly, the management of cancer depends on lowering your blood sugar, elevating your ketone bodies, because now you start to starve the hell out of these tumor cells. And then you come in with a specific low doses of drugs that hit that glutamine mitochondrial substrate level phosphorylation, and people will survive much, much longer in a higher state of life. Overall survival, quality of life will significantly improve. Why is nobody doing this? Because they have no clue about what I just said. And I publish these papers. I don't know what I have to do. I mean, sit on a telephone pole or something like this. I mean, for Christ's sake. I mean,
I'm trying. I wish I had a bigger audience.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's just like, you know, everybody scratches their head. Oh, yeah, this guy should be. Well, then go and talk to the guys at the NCI and find out what kind. You get slapped down. Go into the Dana-Farber Cancer Center. Go into MD Anderson, and you're going to get slapped down. Cancer centers don't want any part of this.
Talk about the research you've done, because you've been published over 150 times and you've done experiments that have proven these ideas with mice, right?
Yeah, and humans. I mean, humans seem to do better than
you do
mice.
The control group with humans, because that'd be unethical.
Well, they don't want, when you recruit people, they don't want to be in the control group. They all want to be in the metabolic group. But then you can't do the clinical trial, and you say, we can't test it then.
Yeah. But you have case studies as well of these people that have beaten or they've, I guess, you don't call it cured or beaten. You say they've managed the cancer. Yes. The doctors will say you have 8 to 10 months to live, and then it's been 8 years and they're still alive.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. I don't know if they're cured or not. I know is they're living a hell of a lot longer than they were predicted to live. I mean, it's comical and tragic at the same time. You know, it's so depressing and so frustrating. And yet at the other time, it's so nonsensical. The guy that we wrote up for the brain tumor, glioblastoma, Pablo Kelly, who's now entering his 10th year of survival with a a tumor that they told him in 2014 that it was terminal. If he didn't take radiation and chemo, he would be dead in 9 months, 9 to 12 months. And they said he had an inoperable brain tumor. And he would have to take radiation and chemo because the tumor was inoperable. So he said, I don't want any of that. I just want to do metabolic therapy. He emailed me. I didn't know at that time. I said, why don't you? He said, I definitely don't want radiation and chemo. So I said to him, well, let's do this metabolic. I said, you know, I'm not a doctor. I can't tell anybody what to do or what not to do. I just, you know, give him information. Well, after 3 years, the damn tumor now becomes operable. Okay, from an inoperable state to an operable state. So he had the tumor debulked. And at first he thought, whoa, he was on this very restricted ketogenic diet, low carbohydrate, high fat diet, which lowered his blood sugar and elevated his ketones. And he was doing good, felt good. Then he had the tumor taken out and they said, we think we got it all. So he started to slide back into more of a carbohydrate kind of diet. Lo and behold, images of his brain show the tumor cells are still there and they're starting to grow again. So put the fear of God back into him and he goes back into the metabolic therapy and you can see the tumor starts to slow down again. But then over the years, it starts to creep up again and he had it debulked a second time. Okay. After 6 years, he had two debulkings. And then he thought he was out of the woods and started to eat some things that he shouldn't have. And lo and behold, the damn thing starts to grow again. And he has a third bulking. So he's had an inoperable tumor operated on three times.
So, wow.
But, you know, is the guy cured? No. Is he still alive? Yes. He's got married. Yeah. He has two kids. I mean, if he did the standard of care, he would have been dead years and years ago. So does metabolic therapy cure cancer? Well, it didn't cure his cancer. But he certainly has 10 years of life that he would have never had about this. And who knows how long he will live? I don't know.
Yeah.
So people will then say, well, see, your metabolic therapy can't cure. Well, damn, man, the guy lived like five times longer than he should have. What the hell do you want?
Well, then people will say, well, that's a case study. Well, there's other case studies. But also talk about the research that Turkey did, because they used the metabolic ketogenic diet with low dose chemotherapy and they had really good results.
That's right. Well, they read my book. And then they started to modify their practice in the clinic in Istanbul. And they were seeing similar kinds of responses. I mean, I saw pictures and we published the breast cancer woman from Ohio who was given one month left to live. And because the spread, it was breast, went to her brain, it went to her bones, liver, you know, it spread all over the place, a metastatic cancer. She got on the plane, went to Istanbul, and was in the ICU, intensive care unit, for several weeks. They thought she was going to die from her exposure to radiation and chemo and all this kind of stuff. And they gradually brought her back and then started to reconfigure, re-strengthen her body, and then introduce very low doses of chemo while under metabolic therapy. And gradually the tumor started to shrink. And, you know, we published the paper. We couldn't see any more cancer. And then people said, well, you got to wait a while. Well, we've waited a while. And she started sending pictures back to us from Hawaii, where her and her husband are celebrating their 2-year survival. And I just saw Dr. Slocum last month. And I said, you know, how is our breast cancer woman from Ohio doing? Oh, she's doing fine. You know, so there's a woman now who's lived several more. I wish she cured. Who knows? But the fact is that she's alive and she seems to be doing well and she's getting on with her life. I have no idea whether she's going to be cured, but all I know is she's living a hell of a lot longer than she was predicted to live using standards of care and probably would have been dead a long time ago.
Yeah.
So we have Guy Tannenbaum. Maggie Jones and Brad Jones are producing a big documentary called The Cancer Revolution, which embodies all of the stuff that I've been talking about. And they're collecting one after another of these stage 4 terminal, so-called terminal cancer patients. And if you go to their website, you can see pictures with these people telling their stories. And Pablo Kelly is one of those guys on there. You can listen to him and you tell me whether he looks like he's ready to drop dead anytime soon. You know, all these guys are looking pretty healthy. They're very excited about what they're doing to stay alive, and they're very enthusiastic about it. And they're all considered terminal. You know, what do they mean terminal? I mean, we're all terminal to some extent. You know, I mean, if you die, you have a terminal cancer, you die from old age at 95. I mean, were you going to, you didn't die from the cancer. What the hell's going on with that?
Right. You
know? So they use these terminologies in a very loose way.
So the keto thing is part of it. And then you say there's another part of the treatment that would take this drug that is, I guess it's, you say it's hard to get, DON, because it's there was, you had some use in children. It was too high of doses, so it had bad side effects. So then they officially banned it in the U.S. or?
Well, it's not banned. I mean, I get it from supply houses for research, but it's not for human use.
Okay.
Not for human use. Give me a break. The drugs you get from those supply houses have to be pristine. Otherwise, you screw up your research experiments if you're using crap stuff. Hmm. So if I had cancer, I'd definitely be using the stuff that I get from the supply house. I mean, that's for sure. It's pure. It's healthy. It's good. But you see, it's not allowed. Yes, if you have a drug that's really good, but it's too toxic, then another way to deal with this is figure out how to reduce the toxicity by maintaining its therapeutic effect. And we've done that. We've shown that you can give small amounts of this drug while in therapeutic ketosis, and the toxicity of the drug goes way, way down, and the power of the drug goes way up. So it's like having a brand new drug. But because the system is already shit-canned it, you can't use it now. Mm. So again, this is a block. This drug would be... But the problem is it's a repurposed drug. It's off patent. Nobody can make any money on it. So what the drug companies are trying to
do is generic. Is that what it?
Yeah, it's an antibiotic thing. It was isolated from a staph strep thing years and years ago. And people, you know, synthesized it. The thing of it is now, because you can't make any money on it, so you take the structure and then you try to add something to that structure to maintain its therapeutic efficacy. Now it becomes a new structure that can be patented. And now the drug companies now become very, very interested in how we can patent glutamine targeting drugs. And now, because they'll make money on that drug, they won't make any money on DON, 6-deoxynorleucine, because it's a off patent kind of a drug. But, you know, I'm in the business of trying to keep people alive. If we have a drug and we know how to use it, what the hell is wrong with trying to keep somebody alive? But we can't do that because we can't make any money on it. So then the drug company should say our primary goal and the goals of all of our research is number one, the revenue generation. And there, by the grace of God, if you survive, that's great. Well, I don't look at it. I look at it just the opposite way. I said, let's find something that works, that really works. Then we can have entrepreneurs come in and try to figure out how to twist this into some profitable situation rather than do the reverse with drugs.
Well, even if people are still in, because I don't want to give people medical advice and tell them to go off their chemo drugs. I'm not a doctor, but
yeah.
I mean, if they were taking the chemo and stuff, you're saying if they did the fasting with the ketogenic diet, they could maybe... potentially their doctors would lower the chemo that they would need. They wouldn't need as much.
Well, that's what we showed in the Istanbul group. They were using dosages of drugs that were at the very lowest you could possibly use while still falling within the regulations. But I asked them, I said, what happens if you used even lower doses? The patients would do better, he said. So, but he can't go into that range. They'll lose their license to practice and all this. What do they mean? What are these guys who lose your license? I mean, the issue here is you're trying to keep people alive, manage a disorder without toxicity, and it can clearly be done. There's no question about it. I mean, the Istanbul group has proven that. We have all these case individual reports showing the same thing. You're right. We don't have to throw out all the chemo. We don't have to throw out all the different kinds of radiation. We just have to know how to use those things in a more knowledgeable and effective way than what we're currently doing.
Yeah, and because that, what are they prescribing in terms of a diet for cancer patients that are going through chemo and radiation? What does the doctor tell them to eat? Hopefully it's not the food pyramid.
Eat as much as you can so you don't lose weight. Infamil, any high carbohydrate foods, something you won't lose weight.
Really?
Go and ask them, for crying out loud.
Is the opposite of what you're saying.
Absolutely the opposite. So because they don't have any understanding of the biology of the disorder they're treating. It's the scariest thing that you can possibly imagine. Well, test my hypothesis. What town are you living in? Where are you? Arizona?
I'm in Scottsdale, Arizona, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I have some friends at the Barrow that are trying to work on metabolic therapy. But you can go down there and talk to guys that are in like breast cancer and things like this, and see, you know, what do they recommend for their patients who are being irradiated and poisoned? What's their recommendation for breast cancer, colon cancer, liver cancer, those kinds of bladder cancer? You know, they'll all say, well, you got to take this high dose here. We're going to give you a surgical treatment, and we got to keep your weight up. You got to keep that weight up, man. You got to eat that. You got to get those carbohydrates in there. And then they'll give you steroid. I mean, this is nuts. I mean, this is absolutely nuts. People ought to go and test. And I, why do I know that? Because I get dozens and dozens of emails from poor cancer patients who run to their oncologist saying, oh, I want metabolic therapy. Oh, no, you can't do that. There's no evidence that glucose drives cancer. Besides, you might lose weight, which would be really, really bad. I mean, what are you kidding me? Don't these guys understand what they're doing? So,
well, yeah, you talk about that.
Sometimes I think I'm going to get a stroke doing this kind of stuff.
The steroid thing. I don't know if you follow pop culture at all, but the comedian Amy Schumer, you know, she said she went on this talk show and everyone was saying, well, what's wrong with her? And she had what's called moon face. And they said these steroids are causing the moon face. She said it was from an autoimmune disorder, that's why she got the steroids. Isn't all this stuff kind of related? I feel like, because I also, I don't know if you're familiar with Jordan Peterson and his daughter. They did a carnivore diet and they both had, or I think the daughter had autoimmune disorder, and it just, the thing vanished. The autoimmune disorder went away with when she did the carnivore diet.
Yeah. Yeah. No, no, you're right. The moon face is the your signature that for cancer patients. When you see cancer patients, especially brain tumor, as soon as you see moon face, you know, that person might as well sign their death certificate, because the moon face is so much steroids in your body. Your skin gets paper thin. Your face gets swollen like this. And some people feel, oh, I'm looking good. Look at, I get wrinkles off my face. I'm getting this. You're this close to death. Because that your blood sugar is going through the roof from those steroids, and the tumor cells are sucking down the glucose produced in the blood from the steroids. So you don't last long after you see moon face in general, especially for brain tumor. It's just tragic. We're killing all these damn brain tumor patients like there's no tomorrow. And when you bring it up to these guys, I give big lectures, and they stand there stone faced. They don't attack you. They just sit there looking at you like you're talking some foreign language to them. You know, it's unbelievable. I mean, it's scary. It's scary.
It is scary. So what are your thoughts on Ozempic, because, or these kinds of drugs? Because, you know, that helps the weight loss. Does that work? Would that coincide with your research, or is this going to make things worse? Or how would that affect cancer patients?
I have no clue. I never studied it. I don't know. We'd have to run a big trial ourselves in the way we do our experiments. The reason I know all this stuff is because I test it all.
Yeah.
I run experiments. I run preclinical testing on cancer, brain cancer, on these different metastatic cancers. I record all this. I publish these papers, and then we adapt it for the clinic for patients. And when they start doing it, they do better than the mice do. I have never treated a mouse with cancer with Ozempic and monitored the change of blood sugar linked to anti-inflammatory and pro-apoptotic and all these signals, all these readouts that you have to get from treating a tumor with a particular drug. So the answer to your question is I have no clue. I didn't do the experiments myself.
Yeah. But I mean, because this would be an easier way to, or a more natural way. I mean, for me personally, I would rather take less drugs. So if I could do the ketogenic diet and fasting instead of taking another drug,
the ketogenic
drugs.
Yeah, that's why we developed. I published the paper on the glucose ketone index calculator, which more or less tells you what you you can or cannot eat. Because some people say I don't like ketogenic diets. I'm a vegetarian. Okay, just eat a bunch of lettuce and see what it does to your GKI. You know, and what do you take a bite of a carrot and all of a sudden your GKI jumps up. Well, don't eat the carrot. I mean, there's a lot of things that every individual can do to determine how they're going to manage their cancer if they want to manage their cancer. The issue with the glucose ketone index, it measures the amount in millimolar concentration in the blood of the sugar glucose and the fat breakdown product called beta-hydroxybutyrate, which is a ketone body. So when you stop eating, obviously you're not eating food. Well, you're you know, people think they're going to be dead in like 3 days if they stop eating. Yeah, a human being can go 70 or 80. And Angus Barbary from Scotland went 378 days without eating anything. He's the longest record holder on the planet. He weighed like 400 pounds. Wow. And he was a fit
but
young.
We would not recommend that for the average person. But I mean,
well, I can't tell you, George, my late friend George Cahill down here at the Joslin Diabetes Center in Boston, he used to do that to these morbidly obese people. He would fast them in all kinds of ways, and they would lose weight and they would get fit. And a lot of the comorbidities would go. But what happens is you store fat in adipose tissue. That's the fat you see, adipose tissue. You know, you have it, you have guts and you have ass and you have adipose tissue is stored in our bodies because we arose as a starved species through our evolutionary past. We never had enough food, so we needed to store fat. Well, when you stop eating, the fat comes out of the fat adipose cells. It's broken down into singular fatty acids that are in the blood, and they go to the liver, and the liver takes the long chain carbon fatty acids and chops it up like a wood chipper, and produces these small water-soluble fat breakdown products called ketone bodies. So the ketone bodies can replace glucose for all cells in the body, except erythrocytes and hepatocytes, but the liver burns fatty acids to get energy. And all of the cells, the brain, the heart, muscles, they're all burning ketone bodies or fatty acids together. Tumor cells cannot use those fuels to survive because they don't have a good respiratory organelle, the mitochondria. So you can make the rest of the body healthy while degrading the tumor. So what we do in the glucose ketone index calculator, you can take a drop of blood, like diabetics would take a drop of blood. You put the glucose stick and then the ketone stick. You push a button and boom, tells you the GKI, the ratio of sugar to ketones in your blood. Normally, you have very high glucose and extremely low, almost undetectable ketones. And then you stop eating and all of a sudden the glucose goes down and the ketones go up. And all of a sudden you get a unity in the blood, where the ratio is 1:1. And when you have the ratio in your blood of ketones to glucose as 1.0 or below, man, those tumor cells get hammered. They're under a serious metabolic stress. They're hanging on for their dear lives in this. And then you hit them, you come in from the side with a little shot of the glutamine targeting drugs, and man, you blasting the hell out of these tumor cells. And the rest of your cells are super healthy because they're burning the ketone bodies. So, I mean, this strategy is just so nice. Now, I don't want to make people think, whoa, I want to go out and do it. Okay, you want to see what it's like? Stop eating for 3 days. And all of a sudden say, "Woo, I might want that radiation and chemo after this."
Right. You don't want to start with the fast. You say to do the keto diet for 10 to 14 days and then ease into the fast.
I would say, let's call it a zero carbohydrate diet for 10 to 14 days.
Okay.
You know, eat steaks, fish, some vegetables, no bread, no pasta, no rice, potatoes, any of those carbs.
What about dairy? Does dairy count as a carb?
Sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. It's the individual. And that's what we did with some of it. We ate yogurt. I mean, you got a nice, low, steady GKI. Wow, look at this. You're really good. You're really good. And then you eat something like a yogurt or whatever. And boom, you see the spike. What do we know? Don't eat that. Not that complicated.
Okay.
So each person
you have this device, what is it called? A Mojo meter that people
Keto Mojo
for like 50 bucks.
You can get it on Amazon, sure. Yeah. You know, that's what's nice about it. Anywhere in the world, you can just go to Amazon and get the meter. And you know, they have a ketone meter and a glucose meter independently of each other. But now they put the meter, everything together in the same meter. So at first we were doing experimental, like you would have to go to a hospital, the clinical chemistry lab to get this kind of work. But now the industry is starting to realize that this is a very, very important for not only cancer patients, but just people who want to get into healthy zones. You get a low GKI, all of a sudden you get much healthier than you were when you had a high GKI.
So a GKI, you said for cancer patients, you want to get a value of 2.0 or below. And for example, like if you drank a Coca-Cola, you it would be 100.
Oh, 100. It might be. We shot blood sugar up to 185. milligrams per deciliter. Now, when you want to kill cancer cells, you got to get it down 55 to 65 and then raise the ketones. The reason why you're raising the ketones, because you can push blood sugars down to almost undetectable levels because the ketones can replace glucose, even for your brain. So you're letting the body take care of the problem, but you're pushing the body in the right way where it, I published this called, your body will, oncolytic cannibalism, your body attacks the tumor and uses it for fuel for the rest of the body. But it will only do that when you push the blood sugars down to such a low level. Okay. So, and because it's like having the cancer cell needs a lot of fermentation fuel. It needs a lot. Whereas the normal cells need very, very little. So as you push the blood sugars down and make the normal cells now need these fuels themselves, then they start upregulating and their sensitivity to these fuels, putting direct pressure now on the tumor cells, which have to have maximum levels of these fuels to survive. The normal cells in the body will not attack the tumor cell when you have enough energy for everybody. Everybody is sufficient with their energy. The tumor cells are fat and happy. The normal cells are getting their energy. All of a sudden, you start lowering these levels where the body now starts to detect an energy reduction. And then as the energy reduction stays low, then there's a self-surveillance within the body where every cell must account for its efficiency and its participation in the society of cells. And when you have certain cells like cancer cells that are not energy efficient, the body, autolytic cannibalism, the body attacks the tumor cell and will dissolve it only because the energy in the body has reached a certain critical level where every cell must account for its efficiency for the whole survival of the body. And when you get your TKI down to that range, your body starts to look for, where am I getting my energy? Who's not contributing successfully to the survival? Oh, these cancer cells, they're using a huge amount of energy to grow in a dysregulated way. We're going to go after them. They don't serve us, the rest of the body. And the next thing you know, the damn body turns on the tumor cell and eats them, uses the fuel from the tumor cell to feed the rest of the body. Autolytic cannibalism. Yes.
That is great stuff. What about the emotional part of this? Because you said emotional stress can make the blood sugar go up because of cortisol, the stress hormone, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And our friend Trudy DuPont, unfortunately, she passed away from a brainstem glioma, but she stayed alive so much longer. And at that time, I didn't know about the glutamine targeting, so I wasn't able to help her on that. But she was our first test person to do the glucose ketone index, and she had a beautiful low, beautiful. She had a handicap from the tumor, and somebody took her handicap parking spot over in Nice, France, and she got boiling angry, banging on the guy's door. What'd you park in my? And then she did her blood sugar measurement, and she said, "Oh my God, my blood sugar went up to 150." And I said, "What's your ketones, Trudy?" And she says, "Oh no, they're still at about 3 millimolar." So I said, "Well, anger got your blood cortisol levels up. Your body raised the sugar, but it didn't reduce the ketones, which was really good. So when you do the ratio now, it didn't look so bad. It wasn't such a traumatic event. And of course, when the anger and you subside, everything goes back down. And in our Press Pulse Therapeutic Strategy for Managing Cancer, which we published open access, we have stress management as a critical component of the overall management of cancer. You need to reduce stress. People are freaked out. And as a matter of fact, the simple diagnosis of saying to someone that you have a terminal, you get all freaked out. You go into a very depressed, and all of a sudden your blood corticosteroids are up, your ketones up, and you're making your tumor grow faster. So what you have to do is you have to reduce stress, gradually drive those glucose down with diet, exercise. Exercise will lower glutamine and make the efficiency of ketone bodies greater. So there's so many things that can be done to destroy this cancer in a logical way based on biochemistry and biology that seems to be unknown to the oncology community in large part.
Yeah. Now, what about, you talked about water fast. Do you have any thoughts on a juice fast or bone broth fast? It all depends on
what it does to your GKI.
Okay.
If bone broth doesn't raise your GKI, don't worry, then do bone broth. You know, it depends. I mean, you can keep a low GKI eating meat or, you know, one pea every other day. I mean, depend on what you're eating. People say, well, I'm going to starve to death. No, you're not. The body adjusts and starts to get super energy efficient from even small amounts of food that you eat. Your goal here is to kill cancer cells. And you want your body in a position where it starts to turn on the tumor to use the fuel from the tumor to feed itself. But if you're taking big meals in, there's no reason for the body to turn and attack the tumor. But so whatever comes into your mouth when you have a low GKI is going to be used very, very efficiently by the normal cells of the body. And again, the tumor cells are going to be at a competitive disadvantage, and gradually they up and die on us. So, and then of course, if you kill the majority of tumor, how do you know that? You do it by PET scan MRI. You can see my lump went away, my PET scan. You know, how do you feel? I start to feel really good. You know, besides, I lost a buttload of weight. You know, I had this, I diabetes went away. What the hell happened to the diabetes? You know, all of these things start to go away and your body is killing and eating the tumor cells. And then you can say, oh, let me see what I can eat. And everybody is their own control. I mean, what you might eat and what I might eat might be two different things. We all have to measure it ourselves. Eventually, they're going to come out with the Free Libra, those kinds of devices that you can actually attach to your skin that will measure glucose and ketones without you having to constantly prick your finger to get the blood to do this. So the technology is coming, and it will be here, I guess, in the next year or two, where people can then get the beeping on your cell phone. You can put a threshold on your cell phone. When you go above the GK, bop, 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 bop. Oh, baby, I can't eat that.
Wow.
Let me modify. Yeah, this is all coming down the pike.
So what about other treatments? Explain how the hyperbaric oxygen chamber, what does that do? That's a tool that is also to help treat cancer?
Yes, but you have to be in good low GKI to get the full benefit of hyperbaric oxygen. Let me tell you. Okay, when you take a radiation to your cancer cells, your tumor, somebody irradiates you, a lump or an area or whatever, the radiation beams come into the tissue and they hit oxygen molecules that might be in the vicinity, causing that oxygen to become a radical. And radicals will damage DNA, RNA, and protein. So radiation causes oxidative stress in the area of the tumor. The problem that radiation doesn't always work is there's so much hypoxia that there's less oxygen molecules in this non-oxygenated or hypoxic event, making the radiation less effective. What hyperbaric oxygen does, and you also have to realize the cancer cell has protective mechanisms against reactive oxygen species. But those protective mechanisms are driven by the fermentation fuels glucose and glutamine. So as you lower the glucose and glutamine, the cancer cell becomes more susceptible to oxygen radical damage. So yeah, you can use radiation or you can go into a hyperbaric oxygen. So what you do is you get into a low GKI, glucose ketone index, knowing that the tumor cells a protective shield of antioxidant is now lowered. And then when you raise the oxygen in your bloodstream, when you have very little fuels to protect them, boom, the tumor cells start dying naturally. It's all based on evolutionary biology, man. Once you understand evolutionary biology, all this stuff makes perfect sense. Problem is, very few people understand evolutionary biology.
Hey, I don't understand. To me, this, what you're saying, it makes sense. Just common sense, like that, you know, eating natural foods as opposed to highly processed foods is going to benefit you health wise. I think we can agree with that. And also, even YouTube has not taken down any of your interviews. They haven't said it's flagged it for misinformation or disinformation or whatever. So there must be some truth in what you're saying.
What do you mean truth? I mean, what number of the scientific articles would you like to change? I mean,
well, that's what I'm saying. That's why, because people are going to say, oh, well, that's, you know, there's always like, anytime I try to have guests like this on, people will say, oh, well, that's just, you know, there's naysayers, right? I'm sure you've had some.
Yeah, because they don't look at the scientific paper.
Right.
So, I mean, they don't read the literature. You know, it's, oh, he can't be right. I said, did you read the same with the biopsy? You know, these guys, oh, you shouldn't scare people. Tell them to take a biopsy could spread the cancer around. What the Christ? I read that. Why don't you go in the literature and read how many papers have shown that? Oh, I didn't know that. Well, for crying, you're the one treating the patients. You should know that, you know, for crying out. It gets me so upset. These just brush things off. Oh, there should be a clinical trial if it were that important. Well, who's going to do the damn clinical trial? You know, oh, well, the federal government should know that. The federal government's not going to do the clinical unless the patients demand it. They won't do it. So you have an ideological dogma here telling everybody's thinking that cancer is a genetic disease. And when you're thinking it's a genetic disease, you're chasing things all the time that aren't relevant to the nature of the problem. Your precision medicine, Opdivo, Keytruda, CAR T immunotherapy, we're going to attack that with that mutation on that tumor cell. All those mutations are downstream epiphenomena. Those same epitopes could be on your liver and kidney. Why do you think some of these people die from liver and kidney failure by the immunotherapy that's supposed to target the tumor cell? What's going on with that? I mean, this is the whole thing. People have to know the biology, and I don't expect them to know what I know. But damn it, I publish the papers, they can read it. And I always say you have to have some modicum of scientific literacy. That's one of the things I do at PC. I try to teach scientific literacy so we're not walking in the dark all the time.
Right.
So, you know, people want to stay alive. They need to read these papers. Oncologists want to help their patients. They need to read these papers. They don't read the papers. We continue to persist with a failed system. People are dying. Do you know that 1,700 people a day are dying in the United States from cancer? That's 70 an hour. I mean, this is six
way
times greater than the fentanyl drug overdose thing. Six times greater than that. You don't hear anybody talking about all the dead people from cancer. 50% of the people that are treated with cancer are dying from the treatments. They're dying from the treatments.
Well, that's an interesting thing that you said with a lot of these like super rich guys, like Paul Allen, I think you used an example. They're getting the latest cutting edge treatment, which are these really dangerous drugs, and they're dying faster, right?
Yeah. I said the rich are going to be the first guys. The poor will inherit this stuff. I mean, they can't afford all that stuff, so they might as well do fasting and ketogenic diets.
It's cheap. Yeah, it's cheaper.
Right. They'll stay alive longer than the rich guys going in for the really expensive stuff. I mean, you have trust in the medical system, no doubt. Listen, if you're doing cardiovascular replacement and, you know, heart work and hip and bone replacements, rebuilding, I mean, that part of medicine has achieved such an incredible degree of precision and success. But when you're dealing with chronic diseases like cancer, type 2 diabetes, we have an abysmal record. In working on that, and all it comes down to diet, mostly diet and lifestyle issues.
Yeah, well, wasn't it like I thought I read something, and I hope I don't get flagged for misinformation if this is incorrect. But
you know what's going to happen? They cancel you, not me.
Yeah. Well, this will be me because I'm saying it. But I thought I read this thing where it said pharmacies, big pharma made $123 billion in 2018, and I think for 2024 it was estimated to be $236 billion. So how do they, that's a tough sell in a boardroom. Like, hey, I think we got a way to help, you know, increase lives and success with cancer. We just do a ketogenic diet and their profits would plummet.
Yeah, of course. Don't forget all that money. It costs a lot of money to advertise all that stuff on television every night. You know, right. You got people dancing, you got people smiling, and then they tell you all the things that are going to kill you if you take that medicine. Normally, this 20% of the commercial is how great it is, the green background, boats, guys smiling, and then 80% of how many ways this cancer is going to kill, this treatment is going to kill you.
Yeah, and then the next commercial is the lawsuit about if you got harmed from that drug from 5 years ago. We told you it was so great.
Well, that's a very good point, because the industry. Lawsuit industry has been paralyzed in trying to stop some of the ways we're treating cancer patients, because they say this is the standard of care. Therefore, the term standard of care protects the people giving poisonous radiation and chemicals to these people, because the field determines that is the best we can do to help somebody stay alive a little bit longer. So treating somebody with a brain tumor with radiation, which contributes rapidly to their death, is not a criminal liability. It's not considered malpractice, because they're considered to be doing. But I'm saying, when you irradiate somebody's brain with a tumor, you free up massive amounts of glucose and glutamine. You throw the steroids on, you get the moon face. That's medical malpractice, as far as I'm concerned, because you're killing the damn patient. I agree. But they're protected. They're protected under the standard of care. So, it might be these treatments might be good under certain conditions, but man, the poor folks have no clue on how to use the tools they have.
Yeah.
Just scary. It's, and I, and what do we have for it? We have 1700 people a day dying from all these things. It's not, not insignificant.
What about the use of cannabis? I read this study. It was a groundbreaking study by researchers from Charles Darwin University and the Royal Melbourne Institute of Technology, where they pulled a cannabis extract called cannabinoid PHEC66 on melanoma cells. Are you familiar with that? Would that work in conjunction at all?
Like, well, you know, I wish I had. I tried getting cannabis oil from the federal. Unbelievable. So I said, listen, marijuana causes an increase in basal metabolic rate. That's why people get hungry. They get munchy, marijuana munchies. Your basal metabolic rate goes up. That means you're burning energy a little faster. Okay. So my hypothesis was, why don't we give mice with cancer cannabis oil while we're undergoing a therapeutic fast or calorie restriction on these mice? Their basal metabolic rate will go up. You're eating less food, so the sugar in the blood will be going down. And that means autolytic cannibalism, the way the body attacks the tumor, would be accelerated, getting rid of the tumor faster. I thought this was the greatest thing. So I try to get cannabis oil. I had federal agents in here checking the university. Oh, yeah, we had to build a special box. I had a drop. Listen to this.
What?
It was a half an ounce. You couldn't even get a taste of whiskey. It's a half an ounce. And we had to build a special room in the university. And then we had to make, like, kids were breaking into it, and it would set off alarms in the Boston College Police Station. And the federal agents were timing how long it would take for the Boston College Police to get to the room where the cannabis was stored. And I'm saying, for one drop, and then I had to go through the state, and then I would get these licenses, right, to do this. And by the time we got everything set up, the license expired. I had to pay another $500 for a new license. And my students who wanted to do it, they all graduated after another. We never got it off the ground. And so I never was able to do the experiment because of the damn bureaucratic bullshit that surrounded this. And then we had to finally have somebody come in and redo the room, tearing the metal box down, the lock box. And I mean, this is nuts. So yeah. For what? Everybody's smoking marijuana on the streets now, and I had to go through all this stuff. But anyway, your question seems to be relevant. I would have liked to have studied that in a really good scientific controlled experiment to see whether or not there was validity to the question you asked me through a comprehensive controlled scientific experiment. Unfortunately, I cannot give you the answer to that question.
Wow, that is fascinating. It's bureaucratic bullshit, basically. Yeah. You're preaching to the choir on that one. I don't understand it, but I mean, I think you're doing amazing work. It seems like we have to get the word out somehow.
Yeah, well, you know, the word, that's what everybody's asking me. How do you get the word? You guys are all talking to me, right? What's going on?
Yeah, well, you've done some huge shows. Have you tried to get on Rogan? I feel like if you were on Joe Rogan, it would go viral.
I don't ask anybody. They come to me. They want to know. They come to me, like you and others, and all these other people. They want to hear what I have to say. I'm not going out. Hey, listen to me. You want to know. I'm not proselytizing any of this stuff. People ask me questions. I answer. Based on the research that I have done over 40 years of doing this kind of stuff, working in the epilepsy field with diet management of epilepsy for decades. I mean, doing this biochemistry and genetics and analysis of this stuff for decades, publishing these papers in peer review, open access, so people could read them. You know, a lot of people, interestingly, who, if you go and look who's reading them, it's mostly the lay people that are reading them. Scientists don't read them. The guys that should be reading them don't read them. It's really
right, because
funny.
It doesn't it seem like the doctors are just, they're kind of just prescribing the drugs that the pharmaceutical companies are pushing.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem like they're reading up on the dangers or other ways.
They're overworked. The poor guys, let's be honest. A lot of these physicians, they've got a line of people out in the hall. They're trying to see, they've got to process 20 bodies a day through their systems, whatever the hospital wants. The poor guys are actually run ragged in this whole system. You know, physicians' assistants and these kinds of things are trying to take the pressure off these guys. We're not we're not training enough people to do this stuff. And they go to medical school and they get none of this information is shared with them, that they should be using metabolic approaches for the management of many chronic diseases, not just cancer. So, and that part of their, not part of their education. Who writes the curriculum for the medical students? That you have to say. Is it the hospitals? Is it the pharmaceutical companies? Who's writing the curriculum for training physicians in the country today? Because we have chronic disease, epidemic of chronic diseases, obesity, diabetes, you know, cancer. All of these are chronic diseases that could be easily managed, or much more easily than we're currently. Why are these physicians? And then when you go to them, especially in the cancer, oh, eat as much sugar as you possibly can. Never heard that cancer cells use sugar as a, oh no, that's a myth. Go on the web, this big thing, myth, cancer cells don't use sugar for energy. Who the hell? Written by a physician. I said, what the hell, man? And the poor guy on the street, you know, he doesn't know what's going. He's going to these guys thinking they know what they're doing, you know. And then they say to me, oh, you don't have an MD. You should know. You can't really know what you're doing. Well, how are those guys doing who do have MDs in the cancer field? They're not doing very well for sure, right? So,
no. I mean, like you said, the rates are getting worse, and that's very concerning.
Yeah, well, there's one thing you have to be very aware of, and that's when they say, oh, no, we've made 33% improvement in cancer over the last several decades. Well, I see all these dead people piling up, everybody I seem to talk about cancer. No, 33. So how did you come up with the 33% improvement? So here's what you do. You go back at the beginning of the 1990s, we had the anti-smoking campaign. Everybody stopped smoking. It was politically incorrect, socially, let's put it that way. It was socially incorrect to be secondhand smoke, bothering me, blah, blah. And all of a sudden, people stopped smoking. So the way you get the 33% increase today is you project, if we didn't stop smoking, how much more cancer would we have in 2024? If we didn't stop smoking, the fact that we stopped smoking, we have 33% less cancer than we should have if everybody continued to smoke. So it's smoke and mirrors, basically. It's not, but if you have metastatic cancer, your probability of survival today is not much, if any, better than it was in 1990. In fact, in 1970. As a matter of fact, for brain cancer, we have not made any major progress in 100 years. Survival in 1925 for glioblastoma was about 8 to 14 months. Survival in 2024 is about 8 to 15 months. You tell me you've made progress. No progress. Wow. So people got to get angry about this. I mean, I don't know what to say.
Yeah, I'm pissed off. Yeah, for sure. And it's this is just like a slice of this whole pharmaceutical problem. I mean, and now they're making those, I'm sure you've seen one of the documentaries where you're aware of the Sattler brothers and that whole thing when the drugs that the painkillers that they were saying, oh, these are totally safe. And then it killed all these people.
Mm. Made them have drug addiction and all this. You know, it's sad. But you know, it's part of who we are is that people like taking pills. It's another thing too.
Mm.
People love taking pills. I don't take any pills.
I would prefer not to. I mean, I would take it if there was something that, you know, was going to kill me and I had to take the pill, but it wouldn't be the first choice. I would rather.
Well, I take pills for acute issues. Like when I had my hip replacement, I took oxycodone once, you know, but.
Yeah. So that's different. But and also like there are some drugs that obviously that you're recommending that could use. But these are not big. What's the other one? Because there was DON that we mentioned. There was another one, imbendazole, which is like a parasite medication. Yeah. And that restricts the glutamine as well. But these are like 50 cents a tablet in India.
Yeah. Well, it's crazy, man. I'll tell you, it's nuts. This guy, Joe Tippins, took the fenbendazole, which is a horse dewormer, and showed that he got rid of his metastatic lung cancer. You got to listen to, you got to get Joe Tippins on here. He's got to.
Okay.
You know. He was the out of a 300 clinical trial. He was the only guy that took the fenbendazole. He was the only guy that survived. The only survivor of the clinical trial was the only guy that took the parasite drug. And then they had to throw out the whole clinical trial because one guy was a survivor, and they didn't know whether it was their wonderful immunotherapy that led him to survive, or was it the fact that he took the fenbendazole. So you have to do another, and God forbid you do a big clinical trial and you show that half the people who take fenbendazole survive 3-4 times longer than the guys who take the immunotherapy without the fenbendazole. You know what that will do to the investors' investment in that particular drug? They'll go, well, we know, why the hell are we taking that when we can do the fenbendazole, which you said is pennies. Now, what happened was that Koreans, South Koreans heard about this and they had a run on fenbendazole. It cleaned every pet store out. The country was emptied in fenbendazole. So it's a big article published on all this stuff. It's unbelievable. But, you know, we showed that fenbendazole, embendazole, these parasite medications, they seem to target the same metabolic pathways that the cancer cells use. So there's an overlap in how the cancer cell gets energy and how the parasite gets energy. So anti-parasitic drugs seem to be knocking down some of these cancers. But the drugs work infinitely better when you're in nutritional ketosis. Everything works better in nutritional ketosis. Radiation works better when you're in nutritional ketosis. Poisonous drugs work better, lower doses, when you're in nutritional ketosis. And that's up to the patient. The doctor will not tell you to get into nutritional ketosis, yeah. But the patient.
They're telling them that they're telling patients the opposite. Eat a bunch of sugar and ice cream, and that'll cure your cancer.
It's not going to cure your cancer. It's going to keep your body weight on. It's for the body weight. They're fearful that you're going to lose body weight. Why do you lose body weight? Well, you have pathological body weight loss and you have nutritional, therapeutic, what we call therapeutic weight loss. When you stop eating, do fasting, that you lose body weight, you get healthy and you feel good. When you are poisoned, if somebody poisons you, you feel like you can't eat, you feel nauseated, you're going to lose body weight. Cachexia from cancer is pathological body weight loss because the tumors are sucking the glutamine out of the muscles and getting it and driving the thing. So you're losing body weight, cachexia. You're losing body weight because some guy poisoned you in an attempt to make you healthy. So they say, here, take the Infamil and the donuts and get your body weight up. I mean, it's nuts, man. And then we had this case where this guy weighed 350 or some over, massively overweight. And they were concerned that this guy from the chemo was going to lose too much body weight. He weighed 350 pounds. What the hell are you worried about? You want to all the weight loss things, just take some chemo. Take chemo. You don't have to worry about gaining weight. I'll tell you that much. Your microbiome gets blown out. Your gut is all destroyed. You're hemorrhaging. I mean, this is nuts, man. This is what they're doing to make you healthy.
Yeah. So what is the cure for the microbiome thing? There's some natural things that you can ultraviolet blood irradiation thing. Are those things that would help?
Well, you know, your microbiome is heavily dependent on glutamine. It's glutamine. This is another thing. You got to be so careful when you target glutamine, because glutamine is used by the cancer cell, but it's also used by your gut and immune system as well. So this is why what I say is not as maybe straightforward as you might think. But we are very, very aware of how we have to target the glutamine issue, because we have to keep our health, and we know the adversary cancer cell is using and needing the same fuel that our gut and our immune system needs. So that's why we developed the press. You can press glucose and you just pulse glutamine to kill the cancer cell, but not harming the gut or the immune system. So this is a strategy that we are working on currently. And our funding for this comes from private foundations and philanthropy. There are people out there, believe it or not, that feel that what we're doing could make a massive impact on the lives of people. And they don't feel that they have to make a buck on what we're doing, other than to know that the ultimate outcome for managing cancer is ultimately what we're doing here in our research. So those folks support us, and we can do all these kinds of experiments to critically test with control experiments, all of the things that I'm saying, because when I'm speaking to you about this stuff is because I have done many of these experiments and I have evaluated data doing this, and I know what the outcomes happen to be, and they work in people just as well as they work much better in humans than they work in mice. I can tell you that. And dogs. Oh, my. I published a paper on that dog, right, with the mast cell tumor on his face. Go look at that. Open access.
Yeah. That was an interesting story, because you said that you fed the dog a ketogenic diet. You were feeding him. Was it raw chicken? And then the vets would say, no, you're going to kill him with salmonella.
Ha, 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 ha. You got to love
an
it.
Animal.
Right? I know, you're going to love it. I mean, it's unbelievable how people react to this stuff. So, this woman, and listen, I must be doing this poor woman. She never went to medical school. She didn't know anything. She's just a dog owner. She just listened to my YouTube videos and she gave the poor dog raw chicken with the bone in it, a little fish oil and a couple of raw eggs. And damn, the damn tumor starts shrinking off the dog's face. And the dog died of old age from heart failure. So that was one cure. I can tell you that dog was cured of its mast cell tumor.
That's amazing, though. Yeah, because like I said at the beginning, it was weird. My cat got cancer. I was like, I mean, he doesn't smoke. How does a cat, how are all our pets getting cancer?
Okay, they're getting cancer from the crap food that we're putting in those cans.
Same as the humans then.
Yes, absolutely. Yes, these dogs are morbidly obese. You ever go to New York City, everybody's got a fat dog walking on a leash. You know, I mean, it's like, what's going on? These poor dogs, they're so perfectly lean in the wild. Wolves, look at a wolf. When was the last time you saw a morbidly obese wolf running around? You know, you know, and they put corn and they put vegetables in the dog foods, right? Put more carbohydrates. Wolves and these kind of animals, they don't attack cornfields. The farmer who owns cornfields never worries about, hey, the wolf used to eat my sheep, now it's eating my corn, right?
Right, yeah. Well, they're doing the same thing to our cattle, right? I mean, most beef now is corn-fed and not grass-fed.
Oh, yeah. But I tell you, do a taste test between corn-fed beef and free-range beef. There's a huge difference in taste. The corn-fed beef is softer. It's more tender. Because my professor from Herman Brockman from Illinois State University owns an organic farm. He said the cows did not evolve to eat corn, so they get massive acid indigestion eating the corn, and then you give them a lot of antacids to reduce the acidity in the cow's stomach, and that's what makes the meat real tender. So, and people love it, man. They love corn fed. If you go to all the top steak restaurants, oh, we got corn fed beef here. You know, and then if you're going to do free range beef, you have to soy vey it. You have to kind of heat it up for a while to break down some of the collagen, and it can be much more flavorful. It is. It doesn't have as much fat for sure, but it was alfalfa corn grass fed cows that were exercised, and this kind. Yeah, the meat's a little tougher. It's much more flavor, and the color is different. You can look; it's darker red than the corn fed stuff. So, but you know, it's a personal choice whether you want the corn-fed or the free-range. And there's good chefs that know how to make the free-range can be as softer. Put it this way, as nice as it can be for the corn-fed.
So, can people, if they started on the ketogenic diet, I mean, if they don't have cancer, would this help possibly, potentially, allegedly prevent getting cancer or having real bad cancer?
As I said in my writings, it's very, very hard to get cancer. When you think about what kind of abuse that we have to do to our body to make it have a bunch of cells growing out of control. I mean, you really have to beat the crap. You really have to abuse your body for decades to get a tumor. Because our ancestors, aboriginal folks, cancer was almost non-heard of. They were these guys eating their natural ways. It was recorded in history. All these guys are showing this. So to prevent cancer, you got to keep your mitochondria healthy, because the only way you get the predominant way to get cancer is damaging oxidative phosphorylation, leading to a compensatory substrate level phosphorylation. So you really have to abuse the hell out of your mitochondria to do that. Now, we live in a toxic environment. We got bits and pieces of plastics. We have these forever chemicals. We're sitting on our ass. We're eating highly processed foods. We're not exercising. All that together will damage mitochondria in some population of cells in some organ. But if you can keep yourself healthy enough, exercise enough, try to reduce your blood sugar occasionally. Not to say we should never eat jelly donuts or pizzas or any of this stuff. I look at that as kind of a treat. You know, it's not something to survive on. But every now and then it tastes really good to have one of these highly processed things. We all love them. We need them. McDonald's hamburgers, Taco Bell, all this stuff is very, very delicious. You know, you get Chick-fil-A. You ever have a chicken sandwich from Chick-fil-A?
Ever had the Chick-fil-A chicken strips with the Chick-fil-A sauce? That's amazing.
Oh, it's unbelievable. You know, so good, right?
Yeah, and the waffle fries. Oh,
God almighty. You know, you go to IHOP and you pour all the sugar on top of sugar on top of sugar.
Sure. Yeah. People. So, but this is an occasional, like once a week maybe or
whatever. Well, you know, the problem is that obviously we're not doing it once a week. We got an obesity epidemic. These guys are hanging around the place. They're waiting for it to open in the morning. You know,
yeah. Just, Well, it's hard. It's not easy, but I mean, if you could try to reduce is what you're saying. And how, like, what would be a realistic diet and fasting, like fast once a week, once a month, three times a year? What would you recommend?
You know, we are an obsessive species of people. We obsess. You know, some people will go out and they'll fast themselves to death, like some of these anorectics. And then, you know, I think we have these social, emotional kinds of conditions. Humans, so many of us are addicted to alcohol, cigarettes, drugs, sex. I don't know. Everybody has some sort of an addiction. I just think the most important thing is just to be aware. A lot of people aren't even aware of the stuff that we're speaking about here. So if you are aware, at least you have, nobody's forcing you to eat all of these kinds of things, or nobody's depriving you unless you're thrown in prison or something like this. And even the prisoners seem to do pretty well. They're not, you know, fasted for, go to prison and we're not going to give you food for 3 weeks. You know, a lot, you'd be surprised how few people would want to go to prison after that.
Right.
But I think we all have to judge for ourselves what would we think might be the best based on the education that we have and what we see around us in our environment. So, you know, there's no mystery why we have type 2 diabetes, why we have cancer, macular degeneration, cardiovascular disease, depression, which is another event related to chronic problems related to diet and exercise. All of these things are all connected to this. How many of us are going to go back and live like cavemen in the Paleolithic period, right? Not many people. So, you know, we develop grains. Civilization arose around our ability to cultivate wheat and rice and these kinds of things. We build cities around the food. That's how we develop civilization. Otherwise, you know, we were hunter-gatherers. And it's not easy living, I'm really a little hungry. Well, I got to chase down this deer now for 3 days, stab the crap out of it, carve it all up. I mean, and then I got to bring it back to the family. And if I don't bring it back to the family, I'm not going to even go back. They won't let me back in the huddle back there. You know, this is a lot of energy you have to waste trying to kill and or dig out some tuber out of the ground. Oh, wow, look at this thing. That's a lot of, people are always looking for something to eat. They're walking around all the time trying to find something to eat. But now we build the grains and all this stuff, and now we're paying a price for the success of our technologies. But I think people should know that the technological advances have another side to them, and that other side is chronic disease. And as long as we can manage some level of moderation for a species that's mostly immoderate. But again, knowledge is power. And I think that if everybody could understand these things, it won't be such a mystery.
Well, and I think that obsessive thing that you're talking about, I mean, people that, you know, maybe they get really into drugs or they get really into alcohol or so, they could change that and shift it and go get really into exercise and really into diet. And then they can be obsessive about that.
Oh, yeah. You got CrossFit. Those guys are really unbelievably healthy. You ever see these CrossFit guys? Oh, my God.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You know, I mean, they're all into this stuff all the time, you know, doing this kind of stuff.
Well, I think that's what I try to do is I try to ask people that are really into shape and really good health. Hey, what are you doing? And rather than listen to my, you know, television commercial or whatever, I try to ask people that I can see them. They're in really good health. I'm sure some of that is genetics, but a lot of times it's their workout routine. It's their diet combination.
Well, we're also in the blame game business. We want to blame obesity on our genes. If it weren't for our genes to store energy, we would have been exterminated as a species. We would have gone extinct. Okay. You and I would never have this conversation if we didn't have genes that stored energy. Those same genes that allowed us to survive as a species during hard times are now killing us by storing so much energy that we're choking off all the things that we need to remain healthy. And that's all evolutionary biology. And if you understand evolutionary biology, everything I'm saying makes perfect sense, and it's just the way things are. But when you don't understand that, everything, it's a mystery. Oh, I had to get that. Oh, I don't know what...
No, I don't think it's a mystery. I mean, I think a lot of this stuff is is pretty clear cut. When, like you said, I mean, logically, if you look at it, what are all these rates of diseases rising? What are the differences in our lifestyle and our diet and the things going into our food? And you, and like in your book, you mentioned the omega six, which people can research that, why that's worse than the threes and the nines. And
fish oils and things like this are very, very healthy. Whereas arachidonic acid, you know, omega fours and these things are much less healthy. So you have to know that. But again, when you're fasting, water only fasting, you don't really worry about a lot of that stuff.
Yeah. You know? And you say like for some people could go really far on the water fasting, but what does the average person want to do with a water fast? Like maybe 3 days, 4 days?
No, you're still in misery. Misery. I tried it, man. It's brutal. Try it. How long you go without eating? You ever tried doing water only fasting?
I've done a juice kind of fast, which is like,
that's cheating. Cheating.
Really?
Water only. Go like try. You go do it and tell me, come back and tell me what it's like.
But you said if you go to the keto diet for 10 to 14 days first and then a water fast.
It's a jump off, like you're jumping off a wall, right? Okay. Mm-hmm. It's better to stair step off the wall than to jump off the wall.
Yeah.
All right.
But so then at that point, you could do 3 or 4 days, two maybe at least.
Oh, yeah. You know, I did a 3-day water only fast with one of my friends. Because my wife told me, she says, you can't do it. You tell all these people and you can't do it. You know, so I said, oh, all right, I'll try it, man. I tell you, brutal. The second day you're looking at your pet in a different way. You know, what we found out, it's better to go zero carb. In other words, eat meat, eat any kind of a vegetable, as long as you can reduce the carbohydrates in your diet, and then your body is walking the steps down into it. You're adjusting slowly. Your body's getting used to the fact that you're not pouring in the carbs. And then when you jump off to the water only, it's not so shocking to the physiology of your body, and you can go longer. And the guys who are destroying their cancer, like Guy Tannenbaum, who had terminal prostate cancer, he had type 2 diabetes, hypertension, prostate cancer. He had everything under the sun. He did these water fasts for 18, 20 days, followed by intermittent, zero carb diets. And he's doing really well. You want to interview him. He's very healthy now. He's supposed to be dead years ago. He's doing fine.
Yeah. You know? And wasn't there another guy, Dom August, what was his name?
Dominic Agostino. He's a friend
Agostino.
Of mine. Yeah, but Dom is always in like a nutritional ketotic state. He's like muscle man. I mean, he and I worked on him mainly for the hyperbaric oxygen stuff. He works with the NASA. He works with the military to improve their physical health and all of this kind of stuff. So he's a fascinating guy as well that will have a deep understanding of what I'm saying. We work together. We publish papers together on this whole thing.
That's great.
So, yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for doing this. This is great information, and I hope we can get the word out. I'll see what I can do if I can pull a string with, I know a guy that was on Joe Rogan. I don't know if he'll talk to me, but I should send him your name and see if we can get you on there.
Yeah. Well, I think it's coming. The change is we're going to have a tipping point at which time the entire world will understand what we need to do and how to do it. Because people basically want this. They want to know how to manage disease without being poisoned and irradiated. And we can do that. It's just the word. People need to know it. The medical field needs to know it. The system needs to know it. And it will happen. It's just a matter of time, you know. But I appreciate the questions. You seem to have looked into some of the background about what we're doing. So the questions are spot on. And I have mostly what I think are correct answers. I don't have an answer for everything because I haven't studied everything yet.
Sure.
But we're in the more money we get for our research through the private foundations allows us to move forward. I bring in very skilled young people. We're always designing new experiments to test the hypothesis of what it takes to kill cancer cells without toxicity.
Amazing. And I think it's cool, too, that if people have questions or if they have cancer and they want to reach out to you, you will email them some more information. And
I do that. I do
free.
That. Free. I can't take any money from anybody. You know, this is, I have a job here at the university. My job is to teach undergraduates and graduate students and do research. But people, if they're excited and they want to see our research progress, then they can give money to the Travis Christofferson's Foundation for Metabolic Cancer Therapies, George Hughes Foundation, and they can give money right to my biology department here at BC, Boston College.
Okay.
So there's a lot of ways. And, you know, I'm getting anonymous gifts, which is great. You know, people don't even want to have their name associated with it. It just says, here, I know you're doing good. I know you're right. And I know it's going to change. I just want to be part of it. And I say, great, because then I can hire a new person and we can do a whole new series of experiments.
Amazing. I love it. Yeah, definitely more money for the research would be amazing. I love
this. And I give it, all that money goes to my staff. So my staff are the ones, and the darn animals, right. They charge a lot of money to do these mouse experiments. So, and you have to do it again and again, and you have to publish in peer-reviewed journals, and it's a process. It's called the academy.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for doing this. I'll put all the links in the show notes, and we'll get this episode up soon.
Okay, Chuck. Listen, thank you very much.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Nice to meet you.